Okay, that seems to be working. Thank you very much, Raj. Thanks also for the invitation to talk with you today. I hope to do a few things, and I hope also not to do a few things. I'm going to talk about the Illinois soil end test. And I was asked to give some perspectives on this test. And what I would like to do is follow up on what Paul mentioned just now and try to place this test in the picture of nitrogen recommendations and going back to what question are we really asking ourselves and what could this test help us answer, what could it not help us answer. I'm fully aware of the fact that this is one of the tests, new tests that was generated in the last 10 years or so, and it has generated quite some discussion and quite some exchanges in our society journals and many other places as well, public meetings and things like that. Somebody actually asked me how fast they could run away from this place after my talk. I'm probably going to leave out some of the discussions that we should be having. The time is just too short for it. I'm going to address some of the things that we've observed here in our research, working with this test, some of the literature that has been published, and hopefully not end the debate on this test, but actually start it with a focus on what questions could this test be answering, where could it fit, and where would it not be fitting. I want to recognize my co-authors in this this talk. We've had two graduate students in our program working on the test for us in its application in New York, and Carl Zimmick, a colleague from the ProDairy program at Cornell as well. So the bigger picture stuff. One of the other tests that we have greater buy-in into recently is the late season stock nitrate test. And we've been running these tests in New York for the last several years, opening it up for farmer availability. We have some interpretations for this test in New York. Basically, anything over 2,000 ppm would be classified as excessive, more nitrogen than the corn needed that season. And we look at our distribution, we find that 45 to 50% of our corn stalk samples being sent into the laboratory fill into that category. Out of the whole set of samples, 20% is over 5,000 ppm. The winners are in the 12,000 ppm ranges. And I have to tell you that we are a state that has intensive agriculture, lots of dairy farming, and also a pretty solid industry for cash grain and vegetable production rotated. So I think that tells us that we have opportunities for improvements at the farm level, and that is what we are trying to make this test work for. We're trying to evaluate this test to as to can it help us improve the management at the farm level? Can we make more of these stock nitrate tests fall into the optimum range, raise the ones that are in the deficient ranges to the optimal ranges and avoid these 12,000 ppm stock nitrate tests coming back. Going back to the basics, if those test levels are so high, where is the nitrogen coming from? In a state like New York, manure is a big one. Many of our other states have sizable ag animal industries. We have fertilizer use. We have rotation credits that could bring us nitrogen to our corn crops. And the biggest one, the biggest unknown source of nitrogen, what quantification is concerned, is the soil organic matter mineralization. So why organic end testing? Well, in most of our regions, especially the humic regions, with the diverse agriculture, that it does include crop rotation, that does include organic materials. I think the only hope for improving our nitrogen recommendations is to account for the ability of the soil to supply plant available nitrogen through soil mineralization. And it's been a wishful thing to have for a long time, wanting to know how much is the soil going to supply, because if we don't know that, a lot of our work on nitrogen recommendations across the diversity of rotations, soil types, will remain guesswork. So what should an ideal soil end test be doing? Well, ideally, it should be practical. It should be easy to sample for. It should be giving us a fairly great wide sampling window so that we can fit it into the rest of our operations. It should be practical with planting, what depth of sampling is concerned. I always laugh when I get reviews back telling me that our 8-inch samples aren't deep enough, and I just reply and say, come sample here in New York and you'll find out that 8 inches is deep enough. sustainable, suitable for routine analysis. We want something practical, not just for the people taking the samples, but also for the labs that are running it, so that it becomes affordable. And ideally, we wanted to predict our application rates, our application needs. That's the biggest hang-up. I hope to come back to that a little later. So until now, the only thing we had available for doing this in most of our humid regions is the PSNT, the pre-sideres nitrogen test. And the adoption in our state and many other states has been fairly low. Labor constraints, timing, depth issues, 12 inches are not that easy to take in all of our states. And the accuracy, it's really fairly easy to mess this up. So adoption rates, although the test is shown to be fairly accurate in predicting if extra nitrogen is needed, the adoption rate has not been that great. Our goal with this test is to find sites that do not need the extra N. And that is also where initially my attention was piqued when Mulvaney and the team out of Illinois started talking about this Illinois soil nitrogen test. Two papers that came out, 2001, Society Journal, Soil Science Society of America Journal, where Mulvaney and Kahn and their associates were talking about a test that was apparently very successful in separating out sites that were responsive to extra nitrogen from sites that did not respond to that nitrogen. It was a fairly small data set to start with, 18 sites in the 2001 paper. They basically identified a soil, what was then called an amino sugar fraction, that could be related back to responsiveness of corn to extra nitrogen. And there were some cutoff, some critical values that were associated with those papers, less than 200 ppm deficient, over 250 non-responsive. And then the paper by Kahn et al. Related the hydrolysis methodology used to the actual ISNT approach, the Illinois soil N test approach with the griddles, the 5-hour incubation in the laboratory. It triggered a lot of interest. I was sitting in the audience when this paper was presented and thought, if this thing can help us, if it gives us a wider sampling window, if it allows us to go with 8 inches instead of 12 inches depth of sampling, if it gets away from the timing of sampling related to rainfall, this could be a good thing for us to be testing. And that's what we started out doing. It showed promise. It was worth checking out. And a lot of us in this audience as well concluded the same thing, even though some of us might have stuck to it a little shorter than others. Studies that followed focused on the test methodology itself. We spent some time, we noticed in the laboratory that wind going through or air movement going through the lab was influencing our numbers. So we built griddles in enclosements to take care of that. There is work on rotation of jars, direct steam distillation to try to do the same thing, incubators instead of hot plates, all sorts of technology to replace the original method. I want to skip that. I want to go into the next set of two studies, basically. Archive samples that were taken off the shelves where there were response data available and reanalyzed for this test, and a new field calibration test. Most recent work, I want to recognize that, is quantification of the N pool, so what are we really measuring, and spatial variability and structure, and I think that's a big one, and that will be addressed a little later on as well. So the field calibration validation of ISNT. Lots of studies started being done. Not all of them entered in the scientific literature. Several were published. I don't mean to be inclusive, so I might have left out some studies here, but these were all studies that basically concluded that there was no relationship between the ISNT values and the economic optimum N rates. There were also studies that pointed out that the ISNT values were a little too closely correlated to the total N values, so that it was just measuring a constant fraction of total N. On the other end, there were studies that showed that it was actually doing a job. It could be placed in our recommendation systems, studies out of Illinois itself, additional work, North Carolina, Canada, and our work in New York. Studies that were able to link ISNT values to either responsiveness, chance of a response, or actual application needs. So the optimum economic end rate. What I want to zoom into is a few examples of what we found in our work in New York, trying to place this test in the bigger scheme of a complex agricultural system with rotations, with animal manure. So our findings, we did rotation studies. First year corn after a fall for grass did not need side res N. Starter N was enough. No big revelation. There are other studies that show the same thing, but basically first year corn did not need extra nitrogen. We can skip any testing. We'll just have to make sure that we can show that on the farm fields, but no need for testing for first year corn. 50% of our second or higher year corn fields, though, also were not responsive to extra nitrogen. And that was telling us that we have a large pool of organic nitrogen in the soil that gets mineralized and that becomes available for crop uptake, and that we need to take into account when we do our recommendation systems. Our recommendation system would have told us to apply fertilizer N in many of these scenarios. I have to say that these were all fields where we did not apply manure, so no manure applications during these project years. What we needed to do there is find something that could identify the site that would not need the extra nitrogen. And the reason for our focus on that is that that's where we could save ourselves money. That's the money we could apply to the fields that came back as deficient. So finding out where we don't have to apply fertilizer is a much bigger economic response than finding out if we need to go with 10 pounds less or 10 pounds more. So our focus of our studies here was looking at the need for extra nitrogen beyond a small starter. And we wanted a test that was more user-friendly and less error-prone than the PSNT. Our first studies, 33 sites across the state, we looked at the functioning of a number of parameters in their ability to separate responsive from non-responsive. PSNT did a great job in this data set. Was very effective in separating out those sites. IS&T alone did not do what we wanted it to do. IS&T alone did not separate out the responsive from the non-responsive sites. But if we threw in organic matter in our models, we could make it a function as a joint parameter. And we did that for both the 8-inch and the 12-inch soil cores. Now, nobody wants to sample 12 inches in New York, so if the 8 inches does the same thing, our conclusion here was we can go with 8 inches, we move forward with that. But we could not do it with IST alone, we needed organic matter, and basically what that meant is that we had an adjustment factor in our critical values. It wasn't one range of 200 to 250, it was a range that varied depending on what the loss on ignition organic matter was telling us it was for those particular fields. So basically, you would need two numbers. You get an organic matter estimate, and you get an IS&T estimate, and you place it on the map, and you decide whether or not you're likely to get a response versus no response. And I don't think this reflects the organic matter per se. I think this reflects depth of profile, textural classes, soil type differences across the board, and that is something that really needs to be looked into. There's some other studies that separate out well-drained versus poorly drained in their predictability of nitrogen needs based on IS&T, and that's the same concept. The other thing we found out in our systems with manure, the IS&T had to reflect past manure applications. If it didn't increase with a buildup of organic matter under compost systems and things like that, it wasn't doing its job. And we followed the study for 4 years, and it did separate out the sites that had compost, the sites that had manure, and it showed a decline in the fields that had no organic input. So that was hopeful. We moved on to the next phase. Corning rotation, first year corn. It was not very accurate, 63%. You could say that overall that's still pretty good, but 63% prediction, six sites out of 16 in the top graph here were basically predicted as needing nitrogen, but the corn did not respond to nitrogen. First year corn. The second chart here, B, is the second or higher year corn, and there, together with the more recent numbers, it's shown to be 84% accurate in separating out responsive from non-responsive. And we had about a 50-50 distribution of responsive versus non-responsive. PSNT in those years, they were challenging years, showed a less than 50% accuracy. So pretty hopeful, but basically wondering what's happening here, why didn't predict any better for first year corn. And that boils down to the timing of sampling. And that is where I think some of the research needs to be. This test is not static throughout the year. It varies depending on specifically the organic amendments that take place before the samples are taken. So here what we did was an incubation study. We have field-based studies on this too. Shoots and roots incubated. And we'll look over time, so this is 8 weeks, at the levels of ammonium nitrate and then the ICE and T. ICE and T was basically following the trends of the ammonium release from these organic materials. Ammonium is released at first, then it converts to nitrate, so the nitrate picks up, ammonium goes down. You take the ICE and T samples at side rest time, you miss that peak. So you're not reflecting the organic amendments that were added to the soil. Yet there is a huge amount of nitrogen in the profile that the crop is going to see and take up. So the timing of sampling becomes important. Now, it would be great if we could sample when we have the biggest peak of ammonium release, but we can't time that. At least I can't. Many of our farmers can't. We don't know when that peak is going to happen exactly. So what we said based on these results is if we want the soil organic N supply potential, if we want this test to give us the soil organic N supply potential, we should be sampling more than 5 weeks after we turn over a sod or a grass alfalfa or add manure to our samples. So it's now a soil organic N supply potential estimate, no longer a total N mineralization potential estimate. We need to add back into our manure credits. We need to add back into the equation our sod rotation credits. There was an earlier chart like this one where it was shown that the ICE and T was very closely related to total N. We looked at comparisons for our data set. This is just one particular field where we did a lot of sampling. We have other data sets that show the same thing. And we're basically seeing that, yes, there is a good correlation if you go across the board, but there's also a lot of variability. One particular organic matter level, 250 all the way up to 350. That is a meaningful difference. It's a meaningful difference that I hope in sometime in the future we'll better understand what is causing that and how we can manage that. To show you what some of these meaningful trends are, we have a field we followed for 4 years, no manure input, continuous corn, followed in 2005 for the first sampling and then went all the way up to 2008. And what we see is the ICE and T numbers go down, the LOI, the organic matter estimates, are fairly stable, and that causes the fraction of ICE and T over organic matter to go down. In this case, it varied from a little over 7 to a little over 4. These ranges for our studies vary from 17% down to 3%. And again, that I think is meaningful variability that we would like to learn how to manage for. Here are the yields, 2005, non-responsive, 2006, non-responsive, 2007, non-responsive, all three above the line. The fourth, 2008, was below our critical curve, and it was responsive to extra nitrogen. So the difference, the decrease in ICE and T, although it might seem like it was not that big a difference, it was meaningful in the interpretations, it was meaningful in predictability of whether these sites were going to be responsive or non-responsive. I don't think we can afford to look at the ICE and T versus total N and say that's close enough. There is variability that we need to learn to manage. That also brings me to a topic that will be addressed later on as well, that applies to all of our assessments in the field, and that is how close to that line, how close to the critical value point can we be? How much field variability do we have, and can we manage for that in the field? So what we are, what I'm seeing appear in the literature is more and more studies that try to address the spatial variability, spatial structure of this ICE and T, and the implications for that for frequency of sampling, sampling intensity, and interpretations of critical values and ranges. So ICE and T-based nitrogen recommendations. I only think this can be a predictor for optimum economic N rates if we have no diversity whatsoever, no crop rotation, similar management practices, no manure, no compost, just fertilizer, then I think it could work as a predictor across our multiple states, our multiple cropping, our multiple agricultural systems. We also have to remind ourselves that it is a predictor of potential N mineralization and not actual, so we need to take into account the weather predictions. And it would be great if we could predict the weather and we can trust the weather predictions, not just in the beginning of the season, but through the whole growing season. In other words, I don't believe it's realistic to expect that from one single soil test. I think it is a potential pool as a risk assessment tool, as a potential end supply predictor to be combined with other tools. And that's what Paul mentioned earlier on as well, to be combined with things like the stock nitrate test and the field history assessment. So what we're doing now with our growers in the state is try to work together to get information on stock nitrate, information on soil testing, information on field histories, and sit down and say, what does this all mean? Can we add this up? If our soil test levels are above a certain level or stock levels are above a certain critical value, how do we decide what to do next? So conclusions, ISNT as a tool to assess soil and mineralization potential. It is one approach to it. There might be many others that could work, but I think we could probably all agree that we need such a tool, that we need to get a better handle on prediction of end mineralization rate from organic matter so that we can fine-tune our recommendation system. ISNT is not measuring nitrate and cannot predict optimum economic end rates across multiple cropping systems. I think it can be used as a tool to as an indicator of nitrogen supply potential, but we have to watch the timing, we have to watch the depth of sampling, we have to watch the rotations, we have to watch the organic amendments that we add to the soil. And we really need to calibrate a tool like the ISNT for use in these various management systems and to better understand the spatial structure. And with that, I'll end it up.